The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 40.
Altitude.
Tower 26 is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
Loves me, my friend, and you hate.
My friend, Rav Garapos at 354.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted 6002 is still active.
Turn in, lights on.
Yeah, okay, I got one. I'll tell you about election night in Afghanistan. So there I was in 2009 on a deployment in Bagram, flying the F-15E, and election night, which is a significant event in the country, was coming up, and set a posture for that. The army had reduced their patrols and wanted to eliminate the military presence around the election centers. I get put on a 12-hour night alert shift on election night because I'm flying too much. As expected, there's troops and contacts popping up everywhere. So we get launched. We go through, I think, two or three troops and contacts. Is like the first one, and Bravo is the second. So we're on like Alpha, which is like 20, you know, 26. Alpha Bravo, Alpha Charlie. Oh my God, this is going crazy. So we reset, and at this point, like the AOR is going crazy. So there's probably 70, 80 ticks that have opened all in the span of like this 12-hour window.
My guest today is Mike Benitez, call sign Paco, and that's a snippet from his There I Was story, which is exclusive for Patreon supporters. If you have any interest in supporting the podcast, you can swing over to patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast, and you can check out some additional content, get early access to episodes, and support the podcast. And as always, if you're not interested in doing that, I always ask if you're enjoying the content, just consider swinging over to iTunes and spend the 10 to 15 seconds and leave a rating or review. That helps the podcast out, and I appreciate it. All right, with the admin knocked out, let's talk about my guest today, Mike Paco Benitez. He is a WISO by trade. That's a weapons systems officer. However, he started his military career in the Marines as a door gunner in the CH-46 and CH-53. Some combat deployments in the Marines, and then multiple combat deployments in the F-15E, and he even has an F-18 combat sortie in there just to mix things up. He has done fellowships at DARPA and Congress in Silicon Valley. I first saw him kind of pop up on social media with the fighter pilot crisis the Air Force was really going after back in the 2014 to 2016 timeframe. We talk about that today. I think Paco brings some good insight to what's happening inside the Air Force and the DoD, which he really has a passion about. And in fact, he has started a newsletter, which is called The Merge. You can go to themerge.co and sign up for it or view the archive there. But it's objective material that's given insight into national security interest. I had a buddy Fitty, who is actually the second guest on this podcast, introduced me to the Merge newsletter. If you're kind of tired of the fluff pieces that you see scrolling through on whatever news app you're using, I think Paco does a really good job of digging into actually the meat of whatever the issue is that he's happening to be tackling that week. So if you're interested in defense and national security related content, themerge.co is another source that you can gather some information from that I think you'll like if you're interested in this type of material. All right. That's enough about that. With that being said, let's get into the episode with Paco. Not this morning, I guess.
Mm-mm.
So just a little Viper reset, you know, turn off, turn back on.
Turn it off, turn on, run a bit.
So, yeah, I was saying like the Merge, what made you start the Merge newsletter?
Well, that's a great question. So if you go back a couple of years, I go through and I read a lot of happenings, what's going on in industry, what's going on in the military. And it got really, really hard to sort through all the chaff. And so by that, I mean, like the things that, while interesting, you really can't do anything with that information in a way to either make yourself smarter or to monetize it, quite honestly, from the industrial point of view. So yeah. Things like, oh, a uniform change, like who cares? Hey, this commander got fired for doing something stupid, who cares? Like, so, you know, deployments, rotations. So what I wanted to cover was that intersection of kind of defense technology trends and forecasting. And so you can see from the warfighter's perspective where industry is leaning and where the future is kind of like leaning towards. And from the industry's perspective, the warfighter applications is some of the promising technology. So it's kind of right at the intersection between the two. And the readership base is pretty eclectic. It kind of spans from think tanks to industry. And that's your normal defense primes to a lot of tech startups to a lot of people in the Air Force, honestly. Some senior officials that I won't list who they are, but there's a lot of senior officials that read it. And then there's a lot of people on Capitol Hill that read it as well. So it's, there's obviously some responsibility in content there to not, and I'm never disparaging about anything, but just calling it like it is.
Yeah. So we're talking about the Merge newsletter, and that's the merge.co, right? Highly recommend people swing over there and check it out. I had a buddy, F-35 guy, who's down there at Eglin, who introduced me to it. So I think by word of mouth, it's kind of growing. One of the things, which I think a lot of people can kind of align with, especially nowadays with the news, there's so much noise out there, and usually it's clickbaitish, or it's there to enact some kind of emotion when you really just want facts. So when I signed up for the newsletter, one, I didn't know at first that the archive exists on the website. So you can go back and read previous newsletters, but it's factual. And obviously it's defense focused, but you can actually get concrete data points that are put together very well. And you can walk away having learned something, which I really like and appreciate. And I know it takes a lot of time to do that. What's your normal flow? Like, how do you come up with this stuff? Are you just sitting there and you see something in Air Force Times that's a fluff piece and actually go dig into the facts? Or is it just something you're interested in?
Yeah, so a great question. What I actually did was I took kind of my normal habit patterns and kind of operationalized it. So I probably read an hour to an hour and a half a day of just different news sources and the things. So instead of just reading it and going, that's interesting, and kind of filing it away in my nugget, I decided to just start capturing some of those things, those headlines. And I release it every week, and I do that on purpose because I do not want to get caught up in the news hype cycle, which is really easy to do when you go to something that's more frequent. And so if I collect something on Monday that I think is pretty interesting, you know, by Friday, it might be nonsense. And so I'm just not going to cover it. So I do that. And then I built myself some processes to basically do it as a one-man show.
Yeah,
I do have a good friend of mine who sanity checks my final draft to make sure my grammar is correct and things like that. And he's a part-time contributor, so he helps out a little bit. And it's I couldn't do it all by myself, so I do let on my friend quite a bit.
Yeah, so obviously you're reading a lot every single day. How long does it take you to make a newsletter?
Oh, longer than you think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like I said, if I spend an hour a day reading and consuming info, and then there's actually categorizing it and then building it into the format that you read, whether it's the trivia or the zoom in section, like here, read more and this is why it's important, or the long format piece, so about 500 or less words on something that's kind of a deeper dive, just from my perspective. So that's probably the only really opinionated section is up front, but it's very objective based. So I try not to lean left or right on anything.
Yeah. And that's what, I mean, I really appreciate. So I first saw you pop up your career. We're going to go through a bunch of stuff, but F-15, F-18, a Marine, door gunner. So you've done a bunch of stuff. Where I first saw your name kind of start popping up was a few years ago, 2015, 2014 timeframe, 2016. So the Air Force is going through a fighter pilot retention problem. They created a Facebook group really to like kind of crush WOMs and word them out. So get stuff, real information out there, doing all these different initiatives to try and make quality life better, to try and keep and retain people. And I saw you posting and responding a lot on there with a lot of like good concrete data and facts, what's going on. At that time, you were up at the Pentagon or up on Capitol Hill working some of these initiatives. Can you kind of talk a little bit about fighter pilot retention? Is that still a problem? What's going on? I know you can speak intelligently about it, and I'm curious.
Yeah, so back to the beginning, I didn't even have a Facebook account, actually, when that was going on. And a couple of buddies of mine, three or four buddies that were, kind of in a group text. This is, it's 5 years ago now, probably something like that. And they're like, they screenshot things going on. And I was like, oh, that's not real. Like, oh, this is what's really happening. And like, how do you know all this? Because, either I'm directly involved or I'm one person removed. It's like the six separations of Kevin Bacon in DC. Like, if you want to get involved and get a pulse on what's going on, it's pretty easy to figure it out. And so at the time I was flight following that pretty closely. And so I could tell you the ins and outs of what's actually going on, reading between the lines, what they're not saying, why they're not saying it. And, there's some transparency that's there and there's some messaging that needs to take place. And so it's all, it gets scoped by the time it comes out of the sausage factory. It's easy to misinterpret what's going on. So they were like, hey, please just join this group. So that's how I got onto that Facebook group. Like I said, I had to create an account to get on Facebook. So not really big into social media back then, obviously. And then while I was in the Pentagon, so I worked a few different jobs. I worked for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs for Legislative Affairs for about 6 months. Okay. And I went across the street over to Congress. So I worked for a senator for a year. In his office, wearing a ditch the flight suit for a three-piece suit, and then came back to the Pentagon to work for the Secretary of the Air Force as the Chief of Fighter Programs for Legislative Affairs. So fighters, munitions, that kind of stuff, back to the Hill. And in that intersection, at the time, we have a personnelist that was also kind of a key representative for the Secretary to the Hill. And there was an obvious disconnect of the rated officer problems and the messaging, because the way that it was kind of diluted and distilled down through the personnel point of view and not the person. And so I joined a couple of internal working groups for the Air Force Air Crew Crisis Task Force at the time.
Right.
And I became kind of the outside individual that was kind of throwing spears and helping everyone think more critically about, here are some options that we can do. Here's how we can message it. And we had a few wins, but I'll tell you, the bureaucracy kind of crushed most of the efforts. We can talk a little bit about that if you want. Again, truth in lending. So I'm not hiding anything.
That's what I mean. I feel like there are a lot of really good and motivated people out there that have really good intentions. And I saw it with a couple of commanders who I thought were phenomenal leaders. But it's like they could only really pick their one battle to like pour their energy into, because they're getting attacked from all sides and there's only so much you can do. But it does come down to like, there's so much red tape and bureaucracy, it seems like, that to get something that should be very simple to do, you have to send a memo through 15 different people, right? Which it should be VFR direct to you to make the decision, but it's got to follow this process. And it just seems like things are stagnant and just don't happen. And it drags out for months, but typically years, depending on how complicated or what the ask is and what money is involved. So, why is it that way? Why can't the red tape be broken down? And I know standard answer probably is it depends, but what is it?
Yeah, so I think human nature, if you go back over history, the first step of solving a problem throughout at least the United States history is to establish an organization. And so when you do that, I mean, think of every branch of government that exists, it exists out of a crisis, whether it's the CIA, the Department of Defense, the NGA, the NSA, Department of Homeland Security, 9/11. So never in a crisis have we go, you know what, let's close these organizations and streamline some things and cut some bureaucracy. It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
They establish another organization and find a way to try to connect it to everything else that already exists. And so over time, you have layers upon layers upon layers of Band-Aids. And it's really hard to cut through all those layers of crap to get some things done. And I will tell you, you know, there was a time where the chief, he had asked us, you know, hey, give me your score sheet. I want to see what's going on here. And so we had internally probably over 50, probably close to 60 different initiatives that we had like come up with. We red teamed it. Like, these are all great ideas. And of those 50 to 60, we had three that had been implemented.
And, is this the Word document that you guys were sending out that had like a stoplight chart of like where the progress was and where it's sitting? Is that what I'm thinking of?
Yeah, that was part of it. And honestly, you know, it goes back to critical thinking. You know, as amazing that fighter pilots think they are, there is a level of critical thinking that very, very, very few people can elevate themselves to fully understand the problem. And so because of that, a lot of the initiatives weren't really addressing the root causes of problems. They were just more Band-Aids. And, you know, at the person that's dealing with the pain, so out in the cockpits on the flight line and in the squadrons, you know, they can see right through that. And that's that disconnect where you start losing the narrative, that you start losing your own team, is because if you're out of touch with what's really going on, then you're not going to be able to understand the real problem. And therefore, whatever solutions you do propose, while they might look great in a headline and they might look well in a congressional hearing, they're not ever going to work. So we had a few initiatives, and here's the other part of it, is that it's very easy to blame Congress, but of most of the initiatives that we had come up with, we already had all of the authorities in law to do it. So one of the things that we came up with, again, like kind of getting out there critically thinking, is, you know, the Air Force, and you know this from pilot training, you graduate pilot training and you get a 10-year service commitment. The law doesn't say that. That is an Air Force policy.
Yeah.
The law says 8 years. And so the Navy, if you're in the Navy, you have an 8-year contract. And depending on what platforms you fly, they're a little bit less, but the Air Force is a blanket 10-year policy. Like, we could change that. And so when you listen to, you know, the dudes in the fighter squadrons, and they're like, well, I want more control of my life. And you go, well, we can give you control of your life back. We can cut this to 2 years. We have the authorities to do this. And the interesting disconnect becomes when you start what ifing it. You go, what if everyone gets out? Well, that's still the Air Force's fault. It doesn't change the situation, right?
Right.
It's like, that's, again, there's, you know, big problems require big solutions, and they're, you know, multi-step, multi-phased approach. And it was very linear of how, like, you know, this problem has this solution, this problem has this solution. Well, you know, one problem usually has four or five solutions that all have to be integrated and applied in order to work. And a lot of that got lost in just the staffing of stuff between, you know, if I've got initiative A, it has to go through these five different sequences to get to the right person. And initiative B has to go through these other five instances and organizations. And then the message gets lost along the way of like, what is the actual strategy to fix this problem? And, you know, one of the big heartburns that a lot of us had internally is that the chief of staff had declared it a crisis. You know, okay, great. What are the conditions to resolve the crisis? Is there a certain manning level, a certain retention level? What are the goals and metrics? Like, nothing. And so eventually they just stopped calling it a crisis. But that's, it doesn't mean it went away.
Yeah, I feel like it just kind of fizzled. And granted, I was in a transition out of active duty into the reserves, and I'm not flying, I'm doing recruiting. So like, I'm now further removed from the problem. I still kind of like follow it to a certain degree, and then through the bro network, but I really don't feel like anything has really changed. Now, there are, I mean, some of those initiatives
did happen, right? But COVID is a variable that got injected that probably affected retention to a certain degree, but I feel like we're on the back side of that. And those same problems are going to start to manifest or are going to start showing again. I mean, do you think there was success out of that? Do you think it was a band-aid? Where are we?
Well, I'd say success is measured in the long term, not the short term. And so it has to transcend the tenure of anyone who's instituting change, right? So you can't measure that. Now, that being said, it's been a few years. So some of the things that were implemented, such as bringing in help to actually restaff the squadrons and some of the administrative stuff so we can stop working 12 to 14 hour days.
Yep.
And then bringing in people to do like neck and back, chiropractor, massage. And I don't think people understand like the toll that takes on your body.
Right.
So that was optimizing the human performance of the weapon system, I believe was the acronym. So we brought that in, and that was, morale goes through the roof. We actually have people who care about treating our pilots as a weapon system, which is what SOCOM uses. So for their operators, if they treat their people like a weapon system, there are different phases. There's phase maintenance. And so for a long time, we were really treated as people. And so this was a great way forward, very small cost, huge return on investment. So that was great. And I tell you that to say the Air Force just killed that program. So,
oh, did they really?
Yeah. It's on the chopping block due to budget cuts. And so people look at things like that and they go, oh, these guys are pampered. We're going to cut that program. Like, well, get ready for the second order effects. So not only are you going to lose people, you're going to break faith with an entire culture and cadre of warfighters that, really could vote with their feet. And they are, and they have.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that, because the two things that I have seen that have garnered a lot of positive reaction, one, and I did see it before I got out, was the civilian like schedulers, UDMs that rolled into the squadron to alleviate some of those admin tasks. And that was huge, especially scheduling. I mean, that in itself is just a massive time suck. The next piece was everyone's talking about the human performance and having, physical therapists, massage therapists in the squadrons, helping them feel better, be better, and perform better. So knowing those are gone, the second and third order effects of that, it's going to be interesting. The piece I saw, which I was surprised, was the number of first assignment guys who would come up and talk to me, especially when they knew I was getting out, and they would express their desire to get out. And this is, obviously it's one example, right? It doesn't mean it's spread across the Air Force, but it's interesting because granted, I was a FAPE, so I wanted to go, I want to get through that first assignment and then go to the F-16, but I still didn't even think about separating and getting out. I was planning on staying in 20 years. And it wasn't until my last two and a half years of my commitment that I really thought about transitioning out. And that was the same, I can say, for most of my peers. I think we were all kind of very similar minded like that. There might have been one or two who, hey, they knew they were going to do their 10-year commitment and separate. But everyone else was kind of willing to hang around and going to take the bonus. But the fact that that's starting to change and guys who are in their first assignment are already thinking about their exit has me a little worried. Granted, it's not my problem to solve, really, but it's an interesting dynamic. And then with the transition, getting rid of the pension, I wonder about the second and third order effects of that. Like if that carrot is a carrot actually hanging out in front of people, getting them to stay for another 8 years or so. What are your thoughts?
So man, a couple of things to pull apart there. So the bonus, that is, that's something that was, created in the 90s based on airlines hiring and forced drawdowns. But when you go back and you look at it's just basic math. So if you say there's 100% of the people have a choice to make, and you look at the Air Force model, of what we depend on, the way our entire system is set up is that 2/3 of the people stay. And so 65% is always our retention goal for rated. It's plus or minus a little bit, but it's about 65%. Now, when you go back and these are guys with 10-year commitments, by the way, that are making a 65% after their 10-year commitment stay the rest of the time at their, so we retain them, or the Air Force retains them. Historically, the number of officers that actually serve a 20-year career is like 40% or less. So you're looking at two standard deviations above normal retention, and that's the minimum to sustain the force. And so it doesn't take a, you know, a mathematician to figure out, like, that's dumb. There's got to be a better way. And so, why do people get out? And, you know, there's 100 different reasons, right? But if you take that model and you break it into thirds, there's a third of the people that are never going to leave, no matter how bad it gets, for a variety of reasons. There's a third of the people that are never going to stay, no matter how good it gets. And so when it comes down to, like, the fight for retention is over the middle third. It's the guys that are like, I'm not really sure, like, this or that. And, you know, they're weighing their options. And that is where you have to win the battle. So if you take that and you apply it to what was the other? I've already lost track of what we were talking about before that. There was two parts to this, so I should write it down.
Well, yeah, no, I hit you with a bunch there, because talking through it, I guess, where are we at? And I will add this additional piece of info is when they did the road show going around talking. There's a group of maybe 20 of us, you know, three fighter squadrons at Shaw. They did multiple meetings throughout the day. They said, every one of you who are in the 06, 07, 08 year group, you'll be in 06, like, if you can fog a mirror, right? Because we don't have enough of you. So, like, are we winning this battle? Are we not winning this battle? What is it going to look like?
Yeah, I'd say number one, I remember when that was going on. What a terrible value proposition, right? that should not be the talking point.
This is not selling me.
Yeah, again, it goes back to, like, understanding the problem. And so one of the problems is they treated, you know, just inside the rated officers pool, you have different types of rated officers. So we got a fighter pilot, mobility pilot. Everyone kind of globbed onto the fighter pilot problem because there was a lot of them and a lot of them were getting out. And so if we could focus energy on that one thing, it'd be great. The problem is they stopped there. And so if you break down the fighter pilot community within the Air Force and you look, there are certain dynamics in each fleet that they have, and those weren't individually addressed. So if you're, the worst retention, and it's been a few years since I've looked at it, but the worst retention across the board for fighter pilots was the F-15C community. It was like 15% retention. And you go, oh my God. So when you break out the numbers, you go, well, that's terrible. Like, well, why is it terrible? Like, well, because the way that the Air Force did the TFI integration of the fleet and the drawdown of the C model, there's only two active duty assignments that you can go to. One is in Japan and one is in the UK. And so if you want to be stateside and have a family and everything, like, your only choice is to go to the Guard, Reserves, or go do something else or transition to another aircraft. And so the retention in that community is horrendous. And so that is one example, but every, you know, the F-35 is going to have the same problem on the active duty side. When you look at the basing and where they're going to be at, it's the enterprise look at the problem. When you make basing decisions and things like that, sometimes they're not factored in.
So a caveman's view, from my perspective, as we look at this, again, there's a lot of variables that go into it. It seems like the push for the fix is to produce a lot of pilots.
Yep.
So in order to produce a lot of pilots, there are a lot of changes that are going on and a lot of different iterations of pilot training that are happening, trying to pump people through the pipeline, or at least that is the perception from a guy like on my end, is you see kind of the surface level view of what they're doing. What do you know about kind of like this pilot training next, or what the efforts and initiatives are to get more bodies through the pipeline to fill cockpits?
Great question. So it's, I'll take both sides of the question. So change needs to happen. That's the first thing. I don't think very few people would agree that, hey, what we're doing, that it was the model that we've been using from up until about, call it 2015 or so, was the same model that was invented in 1940, the exact same model. You go, well, a lot of things have changed in the world. Is there a better way to do this? And the answer is yes. What is the better way is where the debate comes in.
And so, you know, one of the talking points used to be when the talking point was retention is, you know, how do I build a 10-year experienced fighter pilot? Like, it takes 10 years.
Right.
It's so strange. If you can accelerate the experience, that's where a lot of these initiatives came in. So I have a more immersive environment. I can pair several students to one instructor so I can, you know, experience in mass instead of one-on-one instruction. And can I automate some things? And so that's where a lot of these things to accelerate that experiential learning come in. Now, there have been some wins, there have been some losses and some missteps, but you know, I don't think if you never try, like you're never gonna get anything out of it, right? So
yep.
You know, in baseball, you don't steal bases by keeping your foot on first base, right? You assess the situation, you get as much of a lead as you can. Sometimes you get, you know, you have to dive back to first, and then other times you have the right situation to make the right jump. And even then, you're not always going to make it to second base. But
yeah,
if you got to steal bases, you got to take your foot off the bag.
Very true. Well, and this, I had a buddy who is an instructor out at Luke. And when UPT Next first started, it was in the test phase up in Austin. He went out and visited, saw their sims. He was teaching in the seed course and thought, you know, at first, everyone's very skeptical of this, right? And,
yep.
And especially the messaging, the way that was going out and play the telephone game, you're not hitting the I believe button. He went out, saw it, and ended up pursuing to get those simulators for the seed course out of Sim because he saw just the immersive experience you could put students through and what they could gain out of it. And I would agree with you. That's kind of the pieces. I have not been and seen UPT Next or UPT Next 2.5. So I still like skeptical, but I firmly believe like we have technology we can leverage. And as a FAPE, you know, if you were a student coming through and you needed extra work on instrument landings and the simulator is open, we couldn't go over there and do an extra simulator. You know, so the simulator sat empty because it would be a syllabus deviation, which went all the way up to the 2-star, you know, and obviously it's going through all the layers of why this happened. You're like, that's silly. Like we have this technology, we have this capability. Why wouldn't we spend the time to try and make you a little bit better, because maybe this is the thing you struggle on, but formation, you're killing it. So those type things need to be changed, and obviously leveraging the technology that is now available to us to make life less painful and, you know, enhance the learning experience.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me think about this for a second. I think, first of all, truth in learning, I have not been the UPT 2.5. I've not been, but I know enough about it to see what's going on. One of the things about 5 years ago when they were trying to, it's just like your friend, it's like, I don't know about this thing. Until you see it, you go, oh, it's not that it's the bright, shiny object that's going to solve world hunger, but you can
right.
see the potential. And one of the best things that we ever did was we took one of the early prototypes for UPT Next, the console, and we shipped it to the Pentagon. And I think most people know this story. So we shipped it to the Pentagon, and there was an AETC liaison who works in the Pentagon, and they have an office okay. in the basement. And so they stuffed this thing in their office, and they kind of went out over the bro net of like, hey guys, like we have this here, like come check it out. So I went down and you know, played with it enough, and I'm like, okay, like here's what I'm going to do. Every time I see someone that says something bad, I'm going to bring them down here and put them in the sim. And sure enough, we had the amount of people we cycled through that thing in the Pentagon, the people like, Adam, I don't buy into this. And we had, you know, everything up to like 3- or 4-star generals that were like, show me this thing. I don't believe it. And it's funny, like I've probably brought, I don't know, at least 50 people down and put them through that in my friend's office that's taken up all the space. And it's funny because I'm like, all right, here's what's going to happen. Like you're going to put it on, like you're going to say, you know, two words are going to come out of your mouth. It's going to be whoa and whoa. And the first time they like you sit down and actually three woes. So the first one is like, here's this thing, like put the headset on. And then they put the headset on, they start looking around and they go, whoa, because they're immersed in this environment and it's an airborne, it's not freeze, it's an airborne aircraft. And they ask them like, what airplane do you want to fly? Like, oh, I don't know. Like, we'll pick one. We have a menu of like 50 airplanes and you click a button and the whole cockpit changes in virtual reality. And like, oh, I'm going to fly a P-38. Okay. Oop, P-38. And they go, whoa. Like, all right, I'm going to take you off freeze. Like, here's your, here are your controls and this and that. And then they go, well, what are these controls? Like, oh, forgot to tell you, everything that you're seeing from the computer to the displays to the stick, the throttle, we bought it all off of Amazon. And they go, whoa. And then they go, ready? They go, play. And as soon as the simulation starts, that's the third whoa. They go, whoa, this is crazy. And you see them do like aileron rolls and, you know, they'll fly around the Brooklyn Bridge, and because you can put them anywhere in the world too. And so even though it had, you know, obvious shortcomings, you can see the effect of being immersed in that kind of environment. Now, obviously, there's a lot of way to go when you get to HOTAS and things like that. And when you get to like reconfigurable cockpits, you know, that's where it's going to be really interesting. Like you get to like T7, where you can, you know, dial up a cockpit configuration, and eventually it'll be I forget the actual term, but you basically push a button and it changes the way the aircraft flies. And so you can make it fly like an F-22 or make it fly like an F-16 or make it fly like a, you know, B-1. And so, you know, those types of things are ways to automate and accelerate the experiential process that is learning. Do you see, you're talking about landing, you know, back in the UPT type days. Did you see the article? One of the links I put in the merge from last week is about the H-60 pilot.
No.
So there was an H-60 pilot. He was a lieutenant actually, or he was a warrant officer, one of those. And he had come up with this idea about, I wonder if I can just put a camera in my cockpit that will just look at all the gauges. And he basically wrote a script that would scrape the data off the gauges and digitize it. And then he built basically like, here's what the optimal like landing profile glide slope looks. So, and then he basically folded that over onto itself. And now he has an automated instructor that debriefs him when he flies. It can go, hey, your approach was too steep or your approach was too shallow. Now you take that. So you have a lifelong now data points of collection of like, historically I come in, you know, steep or shallow, and it can debrief you automatically. And that's just one guy with an idea and a camera was able to do that. That's not a funded program. It was just a guy who had an interest in, you know, how can I do this better? And that's just the guy sitting next to him giving him a debrief, but there's actual data there. Collect the data and debrief it.
Yeah. It's objective. It's not subjective and feel and based on someone else's experience or vice versa. That's interesting. I think that's what's going to change, and it's a great analogy you have. Like at some point, you know, you got to try to steal second base. Maybe you dive back to first, maybe you make it, maybe you don't, but trying these things. So do you think the environment is still there and supportive where these ideas, if you come up with it and you flush it out a little bit, that the Air Force is willing to try or put energy behind it? Or is it, have we kind of, we've left that phase and now we're down the road of just trying to push people through?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you think of like the startup methodology, so imagine that was a startup company. And so the two things that they're going to want out of that startup is feedback from the customer. So I've delivered a product, how is it going? And so I can iterate. So build, measure, learn, repeat. And the other part is being able to pivot when it doesn't work. And so as a military, we're generally not good at pivoting. We're really good at canceling or just slugging it through and go, this is the way, like it'll be like this forever. So really bad at pivoting, and we're not really good, ironically, we're not really good at feedback. And so when I worked in the Pentagon, that was kind of the running joke of like, look, it's the Air Force who like builds warfighters that has a credence of there's no rank in a debrief, and we debrief everything so we can get smarter and we can all learn. No one debriefs any decisions or anything in the Pentagon. It's on to the next crisis. The dichotomy of you know, what you say and what you do at different levels of the bureaucracy is really, really fascinating. And so as we deliver this product to different fleets, whether it's mobility, fighters, they all have things they have not gotten, right? And so the issue is providing that honest debrief of like, these are the disconnects. This guy is showing up and does not have airmanship, but he understands, you know, how an airplane flies. He understands the instruments. He does not have airmanship. And, you know, airmanship's kind of a squishy term, as you know, like what does that mean? Just like situational awareness, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much SA do you have? Well, 10 until it's 0. And you go, I have no idea what's going on. So it's very binary. Airmanship's a little bit of the same way. But being able to provide that feedback, number one, and number two, a place to track trends. So long-term trends, not just, hey, this guy went to the basic course and learned to fly an F-16, but, you know, hey, 5 years later, you know, how did we do with this guy? Like, what, we cut out, you know, 50% of his real-time flying as a undergrad. You know, 5 years later, is he on his like four-ship flight lead, you know, upgrade timeline? Is he on his, you know, IP? And then individually, if he's not doing well, it doesn't really reflect on the person. It kind of reflects on the process. And so that, right. That's another part that we are very quickly to, you know, say, well, that guy's not good. He's struggling. We need to cut him, but it might not be his fault. So there's definitely going to be some victims of the process. Just like, you know, 90% of startups fail. I think we're going to be putting out some products, to the field that have some disconnects. You know, again, truth in the landing, do you want that guy in a frontline fighter squadron that's going to be going somewhere night one right away? Probably not. So there's other follow-on steps I think that have to happen with immersion. If you put a guy through an accelerated, you know, UPT program, and then you put him in a traditional fighter squadron that does everything the same way it's done the past 40 years, you know, that's not going to work either. And so having a lifelong learning that is adaptive and evolves with that, you know, that kind of model, UPT is part of it, but it's not the whole thing.
Which I feel like that's not all flushed out, because it's impossible. Like, we're short on manning, we're short on resources. So when you take someone who's been through one of these unique programs and they're getting pumped right into a normal fighter squadron, the syllabus, the training is at that level is not geared towards it. And I covered a mishap from Shaw back in 2020. So, I mean, the apples and oranges here to a certain extent, but Mezzer, you know, he had never been to the tanker. And yeah, you know, that was part of one of these initiatives, I think, to, you know, hey, we can waive this, or we cut it out of the syllabus in the B course, and the CAF squadron can handle it. Then I had my buddy who is the chief OGV when, you know, they started seeing these guys flow into Shaw who had never been to the tanker, and they're smart fighter pilots and they're figuring out solutions to do it. And that's just, I think, one kind of glaring, you know, example that is easily recognizable, like, he has not been to the tanker or has not done SAT or whatever it might be, that you can easily see. But when you get into the nuances of the training and the airmanship and that squishiness, you might, you blame the person for the lack of performance, or maybe based upon their training is different than what someone else went through. You know, how do you manage that? And I say all that because you have experience on Capitol Hill. Again, my perspective is we don't think long-term, you know, we're operating 2 to 5 years out, best case scenario, or do we have a continuing resolution so we can keep the government open? And then when we talk about doing these programs that really, if we're changing UPT and we need a 10-year look, we need to track that. How are they going to be successful if we need the ability to track for 10 years or plan for 10 years?
They're not. It's, you know, one of the interesting things about that dynamic is that, you know, in the way that the phase-based process works is, you know, you complete this phase, congratulations, you know, here's your certificate, here's your orders, here's the keys to the car, and you go to the next place, and you go through another phase at the end of that, congratulations, you know, here's your certificate, handshake, go off to the next one. When people make decisions, you're injecting some uncertainty. And so risk, you know, you look at consequence and frequency of occurrence. So that uncertainty, the person who makes those decisions is accepting no risk. They're passing the risk on to the next phase.
Yeah.
And that is something that's not very well understood about when people make decisions. They may be taking risk, but they're not assuming the risk. They're passing it off to someone else. And so if you're at the end of that pipeline and you're a combat Air Force fighter squadron commander and a guy shows up, you probably have a right to know, where has all the risk been taken to the point to get this guy to show up at my doorstep? You know, oh, we didn't do this, we didn't do that. Okay, well, and really then the other part of that is it should be up to the person who's getting that product to go, I do not accept the risk. And that doesn't happen. And so the guy shows up, that's your guy, figure it out. You know, right. It's, and that's kind of the military, you don't build your team, which makes us kind of unique as from a leadership philosophy. You know, if you could, you could go out and you know, recruit and build your own fighter squad, you could be the best fighter squad in the world. You find all the right people with the right complementing abilities, but we don't. You build the team with what you have. And so if that's the thing that a squadron commander is going to have, like, you build a team with what you have, then you have to give the squadron commander the tools, the resources, the authorities, and because he's accountable. He is accountable for the mission. And so when you give a guy that's accountable for the mission without the resources or authorities to do it, that's kind of when the military mission fails. And there's a long, prestigious track record of failure that's because of that. And that's not just pilot training. That's in general, everything.
Yeah, we could talk about that probably forever in great detail. And that's what I think. It's a good perspective, a good point, and I think something to highlight, right? That in that CAF fighter squadron commander, he's assuming the risk. And this, yeah, it's just my perspective. But yeah, they can't say no, right? As you said, they don't get to pick their team and it's handed down. And typically they have their marching orders, right? And if they want to get promoted, they're going to go out there and do their best. But they're juggling a lot of things, from meeting everything on their doc statement and making sure that they have the letter of X's and the capabilities and the qualities of people that need to go out there and do the missions on that doc statement. It's a lot. And there's a lot of challenges out there. The one last piece I kind of like to talk about, because we've spent a lot of time talking about Air Force, I want to talk about your career, but I think you have a lot of insight. And again, this is something I encourage people, go out to themerge.co. You can sign up for the newsletter, because Paco has a lot of good info. He's very smart and he puts it in gooder words than me. So go over to themerge.co and check that out. But where do you think we're going to be in a few years, Air Force? And again, I lean on the fighter squadron because this is where I have the most knowledge. But you know, my year group in the F-16 was pretty slim. I think it was like 15 to 20 guys. And then of that, there are a couple that are now commanders, and those are the couple that stayed in. Most guys got out, transitioned to the Guard or Reserve, or just completely separated. And I go back to that meeting where they said, hey, if you can breathe and fog a mirror, you'll be an 06. But there were not enough of us, you know, in 2014 to fill all the upcoming 05 billet, the commander billets. And then obviously based on attrition rates, there weren't going to be enough to even fill all the 06 billets down the road. How do you think that's going to impact the Air Force? Is that something that's, has that problem been solved, or where are we going?
I live in operational test these days. So I do have a lot of friends that are living that in leadership positions and fighter squadrons right now. And I've got other friends that are in mobility, airlift, tanker, et cetera. And you know, the trend is the average age of a fighter squadron is getting younger and younger. Now, you can correlate age to an extent to experience based on what is the average age when someone starts pilot training. And you can see that while they still have a 10-year commitment, the number of people that are staying beyond that in the squadrons are going down. And your second, the second order problem with that is that when you keep someone in a squadron, so say say you're in your F-16 community, there's a lot of attrition. And so we have to keep the guys who want to stay in, we're going to keep them in the squadron flying, which is, you know, that's great. You have to do what you have to do. But the Air Force as an institution will punish that individual. Yeah. And so they don't look like a normal Air Force officer career progression, because the needs of the Air Force said that they have to stay and fly, or they can't go to school, or they can't do a staff tour, even if they wanted to. And a lot of people, poo-poo the staff tours and stuff, but that's where you get perspectives and insights, and you get to apply some tools that you've picked up, and you get to stretch in a different way. And so a lot of people aren't getting those experiences to bring back and bring those perspectives back. And so, you know, I've seen some fighter squadrons that have, you know, because they, like, no one in the squadron has ever been to a staff tour, to include the commander. And they just do not have a perspective that's bigger than, you know, what's going on the flying schedule. And I think the perspective is really, really important, because it allows you to elevate your own narrative and go, what's really going on here? You know, if I fly that third go this day, like, what's the cost benefit? Is it, in the big scheme of things, does it matter? No, it makes this one slide turn green at the end of the month. but is it really like building combat capability? And if you apply that same kind of critical thinking to like, if you're in a basic course squadron commander and you're getting, you know, product, from UPT, we'll just say, all hypothetical, and you're saying, you know, I do not accept this. And you start washing out people because they do not meet the standard. And it's the standard that's been given to you because the squadron commanders don't even own the syllabus. The MAGCOM owns the syllabus. You're in charge of executing. And so if it doesn't meet the standard, And when you get to that point and your leadership says, no, you can't fail them. You have to pass them because we need pilots. You know, at the end of the day, is that something worth getting fired over as a commander? You know, I have a good friend and a former boss of mine. You know, he always called it the Air Force Times sanity check. You know, if this is the front page of the Air Force Times that I got fired over this, am I happy with that? And if the answer is like, yep, all right. But if it's you get fired over this and it's not something you'd be proud of, like, nope. So there is a point of being a martyr for the greater good. But obviously that's a little self-sacrifice.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see, yeah, again, just kind of watching it. I think the problems, there's always problems, right? There's just been a lot of talk about this. And for my generation, your generation, this has been a big focal point of it. And I think we're going to see new problems pop up over the next 5 to 10 years, right? That rear their ugly head. Hopefully there's smart people that are still in that can solve them. But I do think it's different. We need to leverage technology. We need to embrace some positive change, but again, without sacrificing the quality of the product that we're putting out. And I know there's some trial and error and there's going to be some ships that sink and some that just sail away. It's going to be great, but it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out because, you know, from the ground level, there's not a lot of positive, you know, looks at this and say, hey, we're winning this. This is what we need to be doing right now.
Yeah. When I was flying in a operational fighter squadron, that used to be my one. I had a couple buddies of mine that were fellow Apaches, and I say, hey, where's the good news today? Like, I have not found a piece of good news today. So it was always my goal to find one piece of good news. And, more times than not, I couldn't find any at the end of the day, which is not good when you're working, you know, a 12 or 14 hour day and you have nothing good came out of it. That, you know, it's just you're in the grind and you're hoping that, you know, it all work out in the end. You're hoping someone else has a bigger picture that's, you know, connecting it all together. And sometimes there is and sometimes there's not.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Yeah, sometimes we're better lucky than good, but yeah, a good piece of news, right? Which I'll find interesting. We kind of transition here. Have you flown the F-15 EX yet?
I have. So I think we let off of that. So I'm actually a backseater. So I'm a F-15E backseater. And as you know, the F-15 EX is a C model replacement, but it's got two seats. It's got two missionized cockpits with a few differences than the E. But there's only two in the world. They're both here at Eglin Air Force Base where I'm stationed. And there's about 10 F-15 EX qualified WISOs. Okay. That would go fly. So I actually flew an E model at night in the weather doing tactical intercepts on Monday night, and then I turned to a F-15EX OCA sweep sortie on Wednesday, and then I flew a developmental test F-15EX radar run yesterday against some pretty good jamming. So it's an awesome aircraft. It does some really cool things. It'll be a really good C model replacement very, very, very soon. But the difference between the two is where the C model is absolutely topped out in capability. The EX is, you know, just cracking the door of what it can actually do. And so as a surrogate for a C model, it can do that now. But that's not the future of that aircraft.
What is the future of the aircraft?
Well, it will and can carry outsized things. So yeah. I think munitions, other kinds of whether it's drones that it's carrying, so it can something like that. 7,000 to 8,000 pound weapons, so hypersonics and things like that. So those are things that an airplane with that big and that was designed that aerodynamically stable, you can do. To an extent, that's kind of the limitation for fifth gen and a little bit for the F-16 as well. It was designed to be aerodynamically unstable and it's small. It's great. It has some great attributes, but there's some things it just physically cannot do. Like I can't put a 10,000 pound weapon on an F-16 wing and hope that, it doesn't flip over. The size, weight, and power that it has as well, because it's so big. It has a lot of room for a lot of avionics and a lot of high powered systems. And so your fifth gen guys are very selective in their spectrum management because they need to hide. And that's not just, in the radar spectrum, but, emissions wise. Yeah. No, the F-15EX isn't hiding from anything. And so, if it was Spinal Tap, you could dial it up to 11 and, you can put out some pretty good noise and power in the environment. And ultimately, we've flown it. Right now the EX is pretty much synonymous with an updated E model. So it's got the same radar and all the subsystems are all the same, different cockpit layout. But you can take an F-15E and pair it with an F-35, and the F-35 actually becomes more survivable and capable. So individually the F-35 could die in the same scenario, or the F-15E or EX could die. But when you put the complementing attributes of both systems together, it actually creates a win-win scenario. And that's kind of the teaming part of it. And it's so interesting that, it's the Air Force culture that goes back probably 15 years, back longer than that, about fifth gen technologies, about how that's the only way to go. And a lot of that was based off of scar tissue from the F-22 program, scar tissue from the B-2 program. And if we just keep saying it, it'll matter. And I think people are realizing now that there are scenarios that we absolutely need an F-35, an F-22 type platform. There's absolutely scenarios that we need something way better than that. And so when you get to next generation stuff, and we have a very good idea of what the scenarios are where we need that.
Yep.
And then there's scenarios where, we can do something with the F-35 or F-22 or fifth gen in general by complementing it with something else. And so you remember when you're in the military and you had the hearing test, you sit in the booth and it's like quiet and you're, pushing a button and it gets quieter and quieter and quieter. And then your ears start tuning in and you start predicting and you're right there. Like, I know it's going to make a noise. If all we had was with things that flew that had the exact same signature, you'd basically be in that hearing booth looking for that very, very, everyone's heated on trying to cue into that faint sound. Now, if you put that faint sound in a rock concert, 0% chance you're going to see it or hear it. And so that's kind of the different signature aspects and how they're complementing. You flew the Viper. So you know what's better than a GE-129 engine?
What's that?
Two of them. So we were flying last week and pretty right after takeoff, getting our scenario, and we're in a F-15EX. With CFTs, targeting pod, laner pod, because of the Seek Eagle weight and balance right now, and we have our normal like CADMs and our P5 pod.
Yeah.
And you know, we're in the 40s super cruising.
That's awesome, man.
Which is like, yeah. So it's a thing. It's got power, it's got payload, and it's got some range. And so those are good attributes to have to complement the Force.
Yeah, it's awesome. I, you know, a little bit of the fighter integration before I did demo, and you know, the F-35 gets a lot of flack, you know, to this day, and it probably will forever. And then doing air shows, you're always talking to people and they're always asking about the F-35 and dogging it. And my one like limited experience was doing a WESIP down there, and we would do LFEs in the afternoon, large force exercise for those listening who don't know, but where we might take normally 4 Vipers to guard a 40 nautical mile wild lane, we would do 1 F-35 and 2 of us. Obviously, we are much more lethal basically because we're all playing together and we're all talking their strengths and weaknesses that we each have. We were missile trucks, you know, clean the rails and go home, whereas the F-35 couldn't do that, right? But we could share and do different things. And that's like a very rudimentary explanation of it. But again, it's all about playing as a team and playing off each other's strengths, weaknesses. I love the analogy of the rock concert because, I mean, that's spot on. What is the plan currently for the EX, like as far as procurement and how it's going to integrate into the overall plan? If we're talking about, you know, near peer adversaries, which I think that's the new hotness.
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So I'm not the spokesman for the Air Force, so I can't tell you officially what it is. I have my own opinions. It was an OSD assessment that the Air Force needed a freshened up fourth generation fleet. So OSD made that decision. What you can agree with it or not, but at the end of the day, there is a rapid fielding requirements document that says that the EX is a C-model replacement unit. It has non-interference air-to-ground weapons integration testing that we're doing with it. Here, we haven't done any of that yet. We're focused on doing the software regression and pilot vehicle interface, PVI, for the new screens. And so it's pretty far along as far as a C-model replacement. There's only 2 in the world, so it doesn't really do any good. And the 2, and I don't think most people realize that, yeah, we got these aircraft, but they're not real 100% true F-15 EXs. They are, they cut the production line from the Qatari buy, and they took 2 jets from the Qatari production line and then put all of the US stuff in it. And so when you look at EX-1 and EX-2, some of the, there's bumps and things around the airplane that are for EW systems that are for the foreign EW system. So we have actually a domestic EW system, EPAWS, and then we have the foreign bumps on the airplane, if you will, for the Qatari version is, the Dues, I think it is, but it's not installed. So it looks weird. It's wired a little different, and it's wired for tests. So it's, you know, it's an orange wired jet. When we get the next ones, so we'll have the next 6 are also orange wired, and they have some fiber backbone, open missions architecture that's capable. We haven't built a plan for that yet, so that's we're waiting on someone to figure that out. But when you look at what are you going to do with the airplanes when they start showing up, I think you there's a problem, and the problem is like in the narrative, and so. You know, everyone wants the new hotness. Everyone wants this jet. That's great. If you want it to be a C model replacement, go send it to the C model FTU, have them build a conversion syllabus because it flies differently. And if you're a C model guy, and we were out the other day, if you're a C model guy and an E model guy, and you're flying, you know, the 2 EXs against each other in BFM, there are some handling attributes and flight control inputs that are way different and will put you in a square corner very quickly. And so, you know, you have to build the conversion for that. And then ultimately it was a rapid replacement. So we want to get that capability in the field. And here's where the sticking point is that, yeah, you can get the EX to the field. If there are more to buy right now, there are more, we're buying them, but there are more being delivered. Yeah. They have to build them obviously. And so it takes a couple of years, but we can get that to the fleet, but ultimately you just get a C model equivalent. If you keep them in test and we're able to develop these other things and other capabilities. So that's kind of the dichotomy. Do we speed up and accelerate them to the fleet to recap the C model? And you know, it's not a 1-for-1 replacement. So we know like F-35 squadrons are going to be stood up to replace F-15C Sundown. So it's not a one-to-one replacement. And so when you look at the EX and future growth, you know, there's a reason why there's a second cockpit. There's a future growth potential. I think everyone sees it's kind of like UPT. I don't really know what Wright looks like, but there's definitely something here, whether it's man-on-man teaming, being like a quarterback, or you know, battlefield EW coordinator. So you're complementing EW packages from across entire strike packages, not just individual pilots pushing a button. So there's some really interesting things that you can start getting into when you get to that second cockpit. But that kind of transcends the normal F-15C historic mission. And then when you look at where they're going to be, so whether it's active, guard, reserve, homeland defense, if it's going to be have a protection. And so there's tons of missions that do not require the signature of a fifth gen platform, but all the missions that we do today require the fifth gen sensors of the platform. And so when you look at all the new stuff we're buying, you think it's a fourth gen aircraft. Like, no, it's a fifth gen everything wrapped in a fourth gen, you know, body. And so I don't need,
that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't need stealth to intercept the Russian bomber off the coast of Alaska. Like, it's a bomber, number one. I can see him for hundreds of miles away. Like, it's not surprising. But, you know, people don't normally think about, you know, the threat that way. It's not necessarily it's a threat to your target or what you're defending, but maybe not a threat to you. Right. And that narrative gets very muddied very quickly.
And you just need to be able to see it. I think the F-35, then bringing that online, there's obviously a lot to talk about there, but it seems like the methodology of bringing in people from different platforms worked out. Obviously, there's some things that could be done better, but bringing in Raptor, A-10, F-16, F-15E, F-15C guys and gals, they're all coming from different communities, different mission sets, to then figure out how to best employ this new plane and not just, we're just doing air-to-air. And yeah, it's like there's a whole mission set there's multiple mission sets that go along with it. And people from different backgrounds and expertise that can help figure out how to best utilize it to do mission X, Y, or Z. So maybe hopefully that'll happen with the EX based upon what it's capable of versus just a one-for-one replacement.
That's a really great point. So what I didn't highlight is that I said there's F-15 EX WISOs that are qualified. And so we're doing air-to-air with them, but we're also doing some other things. Think air-to-ground, multi-role type stuff. Because it's part of the test on a non-interference basis. But when you look at the front seat, most of the people that are flying the EX, if they were C model pilots, with the exception, I think, one person, every C model pilot, we sent them through an F-15E transition course to get them dual qualed. They flew the E for a while, and then we did a local conversion training for EX, because E and EX, the HOTAS, the displays, everything is the same. It's just the difference of it's through a 1970s monochrome display or a large touchscreen. And it has a few nuances, but going into that, and all of the E, the C, and the EX all have a common software. And so as the F-15C Sundowns, we were trying to merge all the software into one development to cut down on costs. But then there's some compromises that go along with that we've ran into, whether it's what should the HUD look like? Or I want my HOTAS to do this. And so the C model guy, I want it to do this. And the E model guy said, well, you can't, because there's 10 other functions that does in these missions, because it has I didn't realize that. And so it's really good to have this eclectic group of experience. Again, it's like all ranks from captain to lieutenant colonels, from guard, active, reserve, C model, E model. And so it's a really good team. We've actually we've merged our division. We used to have a strike division and a CMOL division. Now we just have a twin tail division. Everyone works in the same thing all together. And so it's been really fun to learn some of the things from the, there's a lot of isms, you pick up from the other communities, as you know, but it's been awesome just throwing it all together. And, it's been awesome. I've really appreciated being part of the team.
Yeah, that's exciting to be, kind of the cutting edge, something new, as it always is. But with that being said, I do want to transition a little bit. I want to talk, we're going to jump back a little bit. You have an interesting path into the jet. You started out as a Marine. What was the, What'd you do in the Marine Corps? How did you get there? And then what was the transition? Why did you jump into the Air Force?
Ooh, all right. Let's go jump in the Wayback Machine. So I, in my senior year of high school, I worked a lot, worked a couple jobs at the same time, and school was pretty easy for me. I didn't study a whole lot, but I got, you know, A's and B's, and I just kind of felt, I wasn't challenged. So I didn't really, my parents really didn't push me too hard on college. I didn't really understand the process that I do now that I have kids. I didn't understand, like, it was actually a big thing, a significant emotional event to prepare to, you know, apply to colleges and take all this testing. I had no idea. And so all of my friends around me are, you know, doing SATs and filling out college applications. I'm like, am I supposed to be doing that? I think I am. but at the same time, I had a friend that was, you know, interested in the military, and a couple of guys who were kind of interested in the military, and they ended up joining as a the delayed entry program. And he's like, oh, you should do this. It's awesome. I'm like, I don't know. So long story short, recruiter talked me into it. It's like, I want to, you know, looked at kind of all the services very, very quickly. And it was very clear, like, I want to do what is the hardest one? Like, well, that one's going to suck the most. I'm like, all right, I want to do that. because I wanted to try something to kind of push myself. And so I enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1997. I was stationed in, first assignment was in New River, which is over by Camp Lejeune. I was a helicopter mechanic. So I worked on, Hueys, Cobras, 46s and 53s. And then, I was getting ready to spin up for a deployment with the MU. And so I got qualified as an aerial observer, so a door gunner on the, okay, on the 46. And we were supposed to deploy September 19th, 2001. And so you look at the timing. So we deployed. It was a planned deployment, not to where we had planned on going.
Yeah.
And so I ended up in Afghanistan in the very beginning of Enduring Freedom, when it was Infinite Justice. That's what it was called in the beginning before they renamed it. So I was in Afghanistan in 2001 and 2002 as a Marine on the ground, basically doing troop insertions from the south, and that was Operation Swift Freedom. And so there's you can go back in the history and look at that. So General Mattis was was this brand new one star at the time that we worked for. So it was it's interesting to see. I saw him, you know, in the when he's a Secretary of Defense, I had a meeting with him one day, and I mentioned it, and he's like, oh yeah. So we sat and talked for a few minutes about it.
Right.
So that was
were you at a bastion?
Well, no, it was before that. So we were up in Pakistan, and then we went up to Rhino, so FOB Rhino, it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And then we were actually in Kandahar. So I've got pictures of me in 2001, like in front of the Kandahar airfield.
Yeah.
You know, signed with like probably green Humvees and stuff, you know, all we had back then, just, you know, put it in there. So flew missions out of there, flying the 46, doing assault raids and picking up bad guys and stuff like that. So I did that, and I figured I was actually the end of my tour. So we were married, had a kid when I went on deployment, actually reenlisted going through the Suez Canal on the way to Afghanistan in 2001. And I reenlisted with the assignment guarantee to go to Hawaii. So, oh, that sounds great. Go there. Let me get my school things in order. Cause now I know that, like, I don't want to play GI Joe forever. I need to figure something out. So, I came back from Afghanistan, moved to Hawaii. I doubled up on school. I probably set a world record for gained a college degree in the fastest amount of time possible. In that time, I said, well, you know, by the time I get done, I'll have about 8 years in. And, you know, if I get to 20, I get a little pension. Like, this Air Force thing looks like it's the opposite of what I'm doing now. Like, I'm kind of getting tired of what I'm doing. Like, that's opposite. I get more money. It's like supposed to be like, you know, the chair force. It'll be great. Yeah. And so I go talk to a recruiter. I'm like, yeah, I want to be a pilot. And is that a thing? And at the time, I'm like, well, like if you have a pilot license and all this, you have like a 7% chance, because we just had way too many. I'm like, oh, that sucks. I go, well, you can be this navigator if you want. Like, it has like a 98% selection rate. I was like, oh, that sounds dumb. I don't want to do that. And it's like a staff sergeant recruiter. And he's like, well, there's a sub career field called the weapons systems officer. I go, oh, what's that? He goes, oh, they only have it on the B-1 and the F-15E. But I can't give that to you. You have to apply for it and like compete for it. I go, okay, I'll do that. I'll win. I know. And so I applied, and I had to, long story,
I'd apply to get an exemption from the Marine Corps to go apply to the Air Force on condition of acceptance. So I had to pick something that I was going to pretty sure I got picked up. Then I got deployed to Iraq while this process was going on. So I deployed and I got requalled on 53s as a door gunner. And so I ended up going to Japan, getting on a 31st view, sailing over to the Middle East, offloading into Kuwait, pushing up to Iraq. And we were based out of Al Asad during Operation Phantom Fury, so the Battle of Fallujah. So yeah. We're flying, troop lifts and assault raids all over the city and all over, northwestern Iraq. And I get an email saying, "Hey, congratulations, you've been selected to go to the Air Force." I'm like, "Oh, awesome! Oh, I'll take care of this when I get home in a few months." Like, no, you don't understand. Like, you have 30 days to report to MEPS for your physical. Otherwise, like, you lose your spot. Oh crap! So that's I probably write a book about that. But long story short, I ended up E&E my way across the world home from Iraq to Kuwait. I caught a flight from Kuwait to Heathrow, and then Heathrow to Atlanta, Atlanta to LA, LA to Honolulu, back home. And by the time I was gone for probably 5 or 6 months, my entire chain of command had retired. And now everyone's like, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm coming back from deployment to check out and go in the Air Force." They're like, "No, you're not." Like, so it was not easy, but I finally like I'm not making this up. Here's the paperwork. Like, "Oh, you forged the paperwork." No. So long story short, I ended up getting out, and I ended up checking into the Air Force Officer Training School one day late because I could not get on the bus to go to the Air Force processing because I had one day left in the Marine Corps. So I had to wait till midnight to be processed out of the Marine Corps to then the next day be processed into the Air Force. So I showed up to OTS one day late. And of course it's like, "Oh, who's this guy? You think you're special?" Like, "Oh Jesus, you have no idea what I just went through to get here." And the funny part about OTS was that they have a list of like, who are the prior enlisteds. But again, it's funny how systems work. They only look at prior Air Force.
Right.
And so I went the first probably 2 or 3 weeks in OTS, just not telling anyone. I've been through Marine Corps boot camp, like Air Force Officer School is going to be fun. And so it was a good time. And so in that, they're like, "Hey, I was so dumb. I didn't know anything. I'm a little bit better, but I'm still dumb and don't know anything." But at the time, I'm in 8 years now in the military. I'm in the Air Force Officer Training School to be a navigator. And I go to the DFAC or the lunch hall. They have all these posters and stuff of all these aircraft, fighters, bombers, and all. I couldn't tell you the difference between an F-15, an F-18, an F-16. I couldn't tell you the difference. I have no idea. I'm like, "I'm just happy to be here. I'll figure it out." And so I applied to this thing, got picked up. I went through nav training in Pensacola, which was joint at the times.
Yeah,
which was awesome. Terrible. So it was like half Navy, half Air Force and some Marines. Yeah. And then ended up going tracking the Strike Eagle. And then, so here I am. Yeah, a couple ops assignments, weapons school, taught at the FTU, a couple thousand hours. And then, so I flew that for a while. And then I do have, I think you pointed it out, I do have one sortie in an F-18.
Counts.
It counts. So again, crazy stories. So I ended up flying in a FA-18F off the USS Ronald Reagan on a combat mission as one Bravo, as a lieutenant.
How did that happen? Other than the fact that I know, like, probably blanket statements, the Navy, and just anything goes.
Yeah, we were our LNOs, and we were all deployed from one of my first deployments as in the Air Force. So my third deployment to date, third combat deployment, first Air Force deployment. And the LNOs at our squadrons and the boat sat next to each other at the KOC, and like, "Hey, wouldn't it be great if we like swap backseaters?" Like, "Yeah, let's do that." So they worked it all out. And so we sent two lieutenants from Bagram, down to Bahrain to catch a COD flight to the Reagan. And then they were going to send two Navy Wizzos kind of reverse path up to Bagram. And apparently what had happened is while we were en route, the Navy changed their mind and decided not to send their guys to us. Because they said, well, if the ship leaves, we can't get them back. And like that, we don't accept that risk. But the Air Force is like, well, if the ship leaves and we can't get our guys back, we do accept that risk. They're just lieutenants. We don't care.
It's actually better.
Yeah. So I ended up going down. The two of us went down there, me and a buddy of mine. And they had three sorties. And there was two of us. And I'm like, pick which ones you want. And so my buddy got to do a day and a night kind of local training sorties. And then I got to do the like 6.5 or 7.0 beach sortie up to OEF.
And, that's awesome.
I got so close. I had troops in contact. I had nine land and everything. I sank. Oh, and this would be fantastic. I get the guided and a laser guided bomb flying an F-18 as a lieutenant in the Air Force.
That would have been awesome. That's cool. It's surprising that they like even let that happen. You know, nowadays I feel like, nah. The easy answer is always no, you know? So it's when something like that actually like, hey, you know what? Common sense wise, like, yeah, we could probably do this. It'd be a good experience. And, you know, give some people some more choices.
You know, I told you all that stuff and there's a ton more, but I've been really fortunate to have a lot of people, you know, do just that with me. Like, yeah, why? Like, I'll take a chance. I'll take a chance on this. You know, again, what's the worst thing that could happen? Right. And so I try to adopt that same mentality. I've been very, very fortunate over my my 24 years and counting of service so far, and the opportunities I've had, I've been to a lot of places, and I have a lot of different experiences. I've been stretched in a lot of different ways, and when people are interested in doing the same thing, I see a little bit of myself in them, and I absolutely want them to experience what I've been through, and I don't want to be that roadblock for them.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, that's what the Air Force needs, is guys like that to be willing to take some chances, right? Because you're buying risk. Usually, obviously, you're weighing it, but ultimately, it's going to come with buying some kind of risk when you're stepping outside of the norm to do that. But I think it's important because otherwise, it just stagnates. And then again, you're not putting tools in someone's tool bag, right? If you're not expanding the horizons and doing different things. So I know that sounds like a really cool experience. I always want to fly the Hornet, probably just once. I never want to land on the boat. There's no point in my mind to land on the boat because you're just stuck there.
That was
a cat shot. Cat shot would be cool.
So I did the cat shot and the trap on the cod and on the F model on the Super Hornet. And for people who don't know, the cod, the Greyhound, you sit backwards. So you get launched and recover facing backwards. And then to do it in the Super Hornet, you're obviously facing forward. And those were significant emotional events. I was not prepared for how violent. I mean, you see the videos, you go, oh, that looks violent. Yeah. To actually like experience it, like that was a different level of violence.
So much violence.
So much.
You can speak to this because you did a DARPA fellowship. The Fighter Pilot Podcast, Jello had 06 on there. I forget his name. This is a few months back. I was listening to it. And the DARPA colonel, he asked, he's like, how many, you know, traps do you have? And Jello knew to the T the number of traps he had. It was like, it's a thing of pride for the Navy.
Yeah,
guys.
Yeah. They have Centurion patches when they hit 100. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, you know, I had a buddy on here who did a Hornet exchange and he got 100 traps, you know, so he could say well over 100. He did 101 traps. So he could say well over 100 traps.
You know how I know that there's a Centurion patch, by the way?
How's
that? The Navy fighter squadron on the boat that hosted us for like 5 or 6 days. They were awesome. And at the end of it, I got a Centurion patch that was like that. All the two extra zeros were like stitched over. And so it had a one with a big blob next to it.
That's awesome.
Oh, great, great guys. Oh, great guy and girls. There's guys and girls. Great, great people.
What I actually in New Orleans, I took a cable for a brake failure and a bunch of Navy guys were there and I took the departure in cable. Like by the time I realized I had a brake failure, put the hook down, take the departure in cable. And caught so much flack, you know, because you're like, oh, you didn't take the approach in cable. Like, no, that's putting a hook down in a Air Force aircraft is a significant emotional event. I'm not excited about this.
Yeah, I've taken a cable a few times. I made headline news for taking a cable once back in. we could talk war stories all day long if you want to hear that story.
Where is that at?
So we were in. We were in Iraq in 2014, in northern Iraq, doing good work. And at the time, everything that was going on in Iraq was attributed to the Navy.
where like 90% of everything actually going on was Air Force, but because of basing sensitivities, we just say it's the Navy. But most things when you read in the press, it says the Navy, it may or may not be the Navy. So we were up in northern Iraq, and our wingman's like, hey, can you check fuel? It looks like you have a fuel leak. Like, that's weird. So we go look at our fuel state. I'm like, no, everything looks fine. We got no cautions, no nothing. And I get clear to rejoin. So give us a battle damage check. Like, yeah, you're definitely streaming a lot of stuff out of the right side of your jet. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. We don't see any. And about at that point, all of our indications started going off. We had a hydraulic leak, and it was like the worst type of hydraulic leak that we have in our aircraft, which is like total pending hydraulic failure. So it's the system that's the backup system basically blew a valve. And so it was like the backup reservoir. So all of the stuff, all the primary stuff is going into the backup system, which is just emptying out. And nice. You can see our hydraulic pressure is like slowly falling. I'm like, okay, well, we only have so much time. So we were supposed to, Kuwait was our go-to place to divert. And we know that because we just flew over it like 45 minutes to an hour before, there was a massive sandstorm that had rolled in. So all the ops out of Kuwait were canceled, runways closed. Like, there's no way you're going to fly through a sandstorm to land there. And so we're looking at like, well, Baghdad's right there. Like, well, based on what we know is going on right now, like, I don't want to go there either. There's no U.S. presence yet, nothing. And so we're like, well, we're in northern Iraq. I guess we're going to go into Turkey. And so we got on guard, and we end up going to Turkey. We didn't even have an approach plate. We had nothing because it wasn't even a divert. It wasn't a no plan, but it was the nearest place to land. So we crossed to Turkey. Everyone's yelling at us in a different language on guard. And we're trying to like, emergency, this and that. And we end up going to Batman, and we don't have hydraulics. We have no brakes. So we have to take a cable, and we're in a fully loaded Strike Eagle. And so I think we had, three JDAMs, four laser guided bombs, four SDVs, live missiles, and, all the weight for our fuel.
Right.
And we don't want to dump the gas because we're in no man's land. So like, I guess we'll just land a little heavy plus all the weight from the weapons. Yeah. So we actually used a targeting pod to figure out which side of the runway the cable was strung, and then set up a approach to take the cable. Long story short, we took the cable, ripped the cable out of the ground, broke the cable in half. It snapped back, hit the aircraft, hit the right engine, and we had to pull our emergency brakes, which then popped the tires. And long story short, it's a really great picture. We're about halfway down this runway, and it's just metal, like just two metal streaks that are like thousands of feet long from the brake stack just digging into the runway. And so we're sitting there like, oh my god, we made it, we survived. It's a dual use runway, so there's actually like a commercial terminal there, and there's a military, so the Turkish military comes out and they surround our aircraft, and we're like, we have SATCOM, so we're trying to talk to our ops desk, which is like 1,200 miles away.
Yeah.
And the way that our jet came to rest, the antenna wasn't pointing very well. So we were getting like just a few clips. Like, I don't know anyone in Turkey. I don't have a divert checklist. I don't have a phone number to call. I don't have anything. And so it was a very interesting journey to get back, get the aircraft out of there. But that's when it shut the runway down, it made the local news because you could see an F-15 on the runway with a bunch of weapons.
Right.
And then that got picked up in the Middle East. So you look, there's F-15s in Iraq. Well, yep, that was us.
We're probably there about the same time. I got there in October of 14 and left in spring of 15.
I was there for... night one in Syria, September 23rd. I know that because I was the strike package commander.
Yeah.
So we were doing that, and we probably left in October. So, you guys ripped out the other squadron in Jordan, right?
Yeah. We ripped out the Massawa guys. And then I want to say maybe the fourth is who probably ripped you guys out.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. We actually had, one which Tally, she was on here and is our squadron weapons officer. This is later on the deployment, but it's still like diverting into Turkey was a significant emotional event for the majority. I would say all of our deployment, and there was lots of back and forth as far as what the ROEs were, if you're going to jettison everything, if you get across the border and vice versa. But they actually had, it was towards the end, we actually had several jets that had fuel issues, and there were different ones. And on this particular sortie, Poker is a weapons officer. He has a fault indication And then his gauges go to zero. And then as Tally's checking her jet, she also had, I mean, it's just like perfect storm. Both of them have fuel issues. So they divert into to Saudi into this one field that we only had a Jeppesen approach plate for. And it was a CTAF controlled, like click, you know, seven times to light up the runway. They divert into there, you know, kind of similar story. Talking on SATCOM, trying to figure out, but it's amazing to see how fast things can happen. While the jets are still running, you know, they see a, you know, bongo truck coming, you know, across the desert. It's like, this is going to go one of two ways. And one of them shuts down and it's an Apache pilot and a Saudi Apache pilot is like, hey, I'm Johnny Cash, you know, and like his accent. And that, I mean, they got the jets turned and out of there pretty quick. And obviously it was a remote part of Saudi. So there wasn't a lot of news and press for it, but there's motivation that runs all the way up the chain and, you know, over to the State Department back down. So it's kind of crazy to see that stuff. And obviously stuff like that's still going on today. You know, you just don't hear about it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, we got in our situation, it was really interesting because when we crossed the border into Turkey, we actually left the CENTCOM. So we flew in the EUCOM. And so it made this huge, like 3 and 4 star generals are arguing about things because now we're in a different MAJCOM and who owns us. I'm like, oh, are you kidding me? Or a different COCOM. Oh, yeah. Terrible. I wonder how bureaucracy everywhere.
Yeah, no matter where you are, right? Like, what's the mission here? Like, let's line up and get the mission done.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, Paco, before we kind of transition out, again, I want to mention the Merge newsletter. You can go over to themerge.co, sign up for that. If you're interested in defense type news coming from fighter pilots, you know, it's kind of no BS. It's objective. I really enjoy it. I appreciate you putting the time in to do that. I know, you know, it's not an easy thing in a lot of time. So if you're interested in kind of really getting what's going on, not the fluff pieces, the Merge newsletter, again, themerge.co. Is there anything else you kind of like to highlight about that? Because I'll have one more question for you, but I'll give you a chance to talk about the Merge if you want.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, every day you have a choice to make. You can either be smarter or dumber. And, you know, if you do nothing, you will get dumber because, you know, time passes by. So make the right choice.
Simple, to the point. The last question I got for you is I always ask my guests, you know, if you found 16, 17 year old Paco walk on the street, is there any advice you'd give him, tips, tricks, or tell him to do something different?
Don't suck and just go try it.
Yeah.
So I think we have a lot of people who don't take shots, because they're worried about they might fail. And so I never had that problem. And, I wish I would have embraced that a little bit earlier in my career. So I try to do what matters, most, and then let the chips fall where they fall.
Awesome. Well, Paco, I appreciate you joining me on the podcast. It'd be fun to have you back on here, talk about some more stuff, because again, you have a lot of great insight. So thanks for taking the time.
Anytime. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed this week's episode with Paco. Again, if you're looking for defense and national security related news, check out themerge.co. Remember, his There I Was stories living up on patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. And you can help the podcast out by just swinging over to iTunes and dropping a rating or review. Thanks for listening in. And until next time, don't bring a week.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.